Hi, we're going to get started. Thank you for coming out today and taking your time to be here in this room at 1:45 to 2:45, a very brief window that we have to talk about what we need to talk about. And the program today is called Adjunct Action Poets in Action. And our panelists all are adjunct faculty at one of the five different colleges, private colleges in the Bay Area that have signed on with SEIU to represent them in contract negotiations with the administration at their schools. And adjunct action, I'm just going to read a brief statement. It's a national drive for contingent faculty workers who across the U.S. teach 70% of the courses at colleges and universities. Part-time workers, for the most, adjunct faculty get compensated in salary, benefits, and worker protections at levels far below tenure track or tenured faculty, and many until now have not had recourse to collective bargaining and union representation. This is changing with Mills College, San Francisco Art Institute, California College of the Arts, St. Mary's College, and Dominican University adjunct workers voting for SEIU affiliation and working at various stages to replace administrative policy with negotiated worker contracts and protections. Today's event is co-sponsored by the Poetry Center. I'm Steve Dickinson, director. The SFSU Labor Archives and Research Center, we have Catherine Powell and Tanya Hollis here from the Labor Archives. Service Employees International Union, Local 1021, and Jessica Lawless is here. And
Celeste and Lefty are here.
Celeste.
As well.
Oh, thank you. Okay. And also Sheila Tully is here from the California Faculty Association. And our moderators today are going to be Jessica Lawless from SEIU and Sheila from CFA. And our panelists, I'm just going to give very brief introductions, and they're each going to read a little bit. Over here, David Book, who has been adjunct faculty at Mills College, writer, poet, editor of the amazing journal Tripwire, which everyone should check out. I think downstairs of the Green Arcade bookstore has some of the books affiliated with the writers here. Stephanie Young is next to David, and she is at Mills College as well and is part of the bargaining team there. And among other works of poetry, she also is the editor of a book with Julian Aspar called A Megaphone, Some Enactments, Some Numbers, and Some Essays About the Continued Usefulness of Crotchless Pants and a Machine Gun Feminism. From Chainlinks Books, an amazing series of anthologies published by that press. Hugh Baim Steinberg works at California College of the Arts, and he also was on the bargaining team. And his work includes a number of books of poetry and a text sound work with his band, Wah. And Jessica Beard is at the San Francisco Art Institute. Among other works, she's completed a PhD that's on Emily Dickinson and her Chaotic Archive. So, whoever, maybe we should start down at Jessica's end, if you'd like to start.
I can start.
Wrote something kind of formal, because that's just kind of where I'm at. My head is scattered teaching at two different schools this time of the semester. I'm going to read from my computer. I apologize. I'm going to start with a quote from Claudia Rankine's Don't Let Me Be Lonely. And she writes, because the foundations for loneliness begin in the dreamscapes you create, their resemblance to reality reflects disappointment first. I remember the moment I knew I was screwed. It was the summer of 2011, and the department where I was a graduate student had finally tightened the screws on our funding. I started teaching outside that institution as an adjunct and somehow cobbled together some assistantships on campus to get my tuition paid for. I hunkered down for a two-year date with my dissertation while working 2 to 3 jobs. I toyed with the idea of quitting, but thought about how nobody in my family had ever done anything like this. At the end of the day, all I wanted to do was finish and get out, the glimmer of the academy having long since fizzled out. 4.5 years later, my relationship to the academy is completely adjunct, and the dream of that glimmer long since forgotten. I work part-time at 2 institutions as a lecturer, and spend most of my other time trying to chip away at the administrative power in those institutions that relentlessly works to destabilize the lives of its teachers. My job at both places puts me at the front of the classroom filled first and second year students, most of them first generation college students like I was, and many of them from low income families. I struggle with my role here. On one hand, I can feel the sense of pride these new students have, having arrived in a place nobody in their family ever has. And on the other, I'm filled with the same sense of loneliness Rankine describes. Sorry, I lost my place. The dream of the academy that started for me when I went to college at SF State and blossomed when I moved across the country to get an MA had started to obfuscate the reality that I was working class. I bought into the idea that these degrees would erase the precarity I'd grown up with. Loneliness is exactly the feeling these kinds of disappointments create, as the world you thought you'd worked yourself into resembles far too much the reality you knew was there all along and had battled before. And this is where my question for everyone in this room comes in. I can't help but see how these disappointments are directly linked to the disappointments my students will face in their time at school. As they struggle to choose between a gender studies major or a business degree, or ask me to look at their poetry in my office hours, I'm frozen. Similarly difficult for me at the front of the class is how to authentically manage my engagement with the realities of higher education and our economy in general, now that my daily life is engaged with fighting it, all while being enthusiastic and encouraging about their involvement in it. My struggle becomes how to engage my students' ambition to get a degree or maybe two, when the institutions that they're investing in don't invest in them or me as their teacher. All too aware of the cyclical administrative money boat that is part of the course in the neoliberal institution of higher education, I'm never quite sure what to encourage my students to do, except, of course, to know more and fight back. But how? They're just in my class to learn how to write. This kind of questioning, while initially disorienting and lonely, can sometimes open up a new kind of space for me as an educator and a higher ed activist. Inhabiting the space of contingency and precarity is economically and emotionally devastating, but there is something powerful about this space, when we can see fully the failure and disappointment that urges us to change collectively. Always inspired by Paulo Freire's pedagogy, I look to the classroom as a shared space, one where the critical consciousness on the part of the teacher and students is a shared endeavor. I see this kind of teaching to be liberating, both to me and to my students. So I'd like to leave this question in the room, this difficult ethical space we all inhabit with our own jumbled relationships to the institutions we both serve and hope to in some ways take down. What is our responsibility to our students, and how do we operate as both unravelers and bolsters of these institutions? Thanks.
I'm gonna read some poems. I've been working on a sequence of poems about birds, and I'll read two of them. The first one's called Zanjiang Ground Jays. Zanjiang ground jays start in sequences of mountains, in progress or plantations, to leave out, behind, relinquish, abandon. Cover has been severely affected by collection of medicinal herbs, Sistanche salsa, mostly found where ground jays live. Their nest not on the ground, tucked into brush, as two needs together, neither naming the other in the courts. No business is the silent business. The ground jays go unpaid, but neither are they slaves. Maybe you will never get paid, or you die after you're in. Your ghost lingers, and the ground jays, seen in pairs or families of up to six, watch you and go back to work. They're about the size of your hand. No one says what they sound like, but I hope their calls are raucous. We take turns. You scratch the parts I can't reach. Sistanche is valuable and salty, a root parasite. It treats the five taxations and seven damages, eliminates cold, heat, and pain, nourishes the viscera, strengthens yin, and boosts qi. I dreamed I was working so hard, I couldn't tell if I was alive or dead, awake or asleep. I was so focused in my captivity, the never-empty bowl of birdseed, the perch, the fear I was going to stay like this. To labor is to lose track of reciprocities, as the ground jays hang out in truck stops, adjusting to us by picking through trash cans. We ought to model our empire on the way birds own space. But all the funding goes both to the people studying the medicine and those counting the ground jays that remain. There is no evidence that anything works, only green verbs in the mouths of those observing nature from positions of design and wealth. A place describing enclosing that which contains ruins, sparsely populated by ground jays, with black, gently decurved bills. And this one's called Wild Turkeys, and it riffs off of a really bad animated cartoon that came out a couple years ago called Wild Turkeys. And some of the actors float through this piece, such by various names of who they were, such as Woody Harrelson and Colm Meaney. Wild Turkeys. Adult males, toms, or gobblers have a large reddish head, red throats, red wattles. Their heads have caruncles. The long fleshy object over a male's beak is called a snood. When you know something well, you develop a name for all its parts. The noise is sweet and devastating, and you must hear it. You are so tender when I get angry about my job. Are you held? Then your breath is zooed. How many lifelike enclosures are you keeping for yourself? How many cages inside you do you want? How many rich people will you let on your board of trustees? A worker must be camouflaged head to toe, crouch motionless, and convey persuasively the gobble of a Love Star 10. Dogs spook this quarry, and no pheasant or duck bolts as quickly. You could work for years and never imitate the booming sound of a wild turkey gobbler. But now you can own the haint from down and dirty and perfectly imitate the gobble of a mature tom. No greetings or warnings. To tilt is to preserve shadows, so your needs are storyboarded. You're stuck in a badly animated version of yourself. Don't be that kind of turkey, the turkey says. And when they go on the private tour of your interior, do the wild animals there reveal their training for the pleasure of those bored bond traders who just want a party? Maybe they'll let you play your haint for free drinks. Green in your heaven, and your timesheets that track you right away. You're propped up in their office. They accuse you of not paying the royalties on your dreams. You say that is impossible. You do not own the rights to my dreams. Never actually making anything, let alone money. Judging of your own diorama, door-to-door taxidermy salesman. Servant class to 27-year-old tech industry assholes. At least I got a nice fucking beard. I got a nice beard grooming kit. Pardoned by the president, a lucky turkey named Eli Cash gets to live a carefree lifestyle, occasionally dating Sheryl Crow, until fellow foul and marijuana activist Woody Boyd recruits him for a history-changing mission. The longer you stay at the cafe, the louder they make the music play. We avoid looking at each other, but no one merits obstacles, the turkey tells you. Now you can play to the dominance of a mature gobbler and challenge him like never before. Dominance overrules the desire to breed, forcing males to leave females in favor of battle. When I'm excited, my head turns blue. When ready to fight, it turns red, so don't fuck with me. In the movie of my life, I'm going to travel back in time before the first Thanksgiving and get a real job. No one knows when that is. Because gratitude is timeless, especially after civil wars. I'm hanging out with my wife and Nunu when a hen and her six poults work their way through landscaping. We're made aware of how much we're just intersections in the master plan, prevent all turkeys from ever becoming holiday dinners. Unfortunately, the two birds encounter colonist Miles O'Brien out to capture feathered friends for all the hungry pilgrims and their investing partners. Seldom alone, going wherever they want to, we make room for them. We're startled how easily we make room for them. When they ignore the stoplights at San Pablo and Ashby, we stop being strangers. Two of us will always help them cross, and the rest of us will cheerfully wait. I'm not sure how so much anger and benevolence can hang out inside me when all I want to do is to have a good time on my day off. In the end, they save all the turkeys, but Miles O'Brien says, "Good luck, this changes nothing." It lulls, and you imagine it won't wreck you, or the turkeys will always be around to guide their poults through the ivy. I will pay royalties on you for the rest of my life. I will pay dues on my prayers, too. I'll be told all the prisons we're building are zoos. If I keep my head up, they'll promote me. This call is as eternal and indestructible as money. Now challenge that boss gobbler and bring him in. There is no other call in the market that emulates your life so effectively.
I also wrote something sort of formalish-ish, and I guess I want to say too, I feel like the story I kind of want to tell today feels a little bit more heroic to me than had this panel happened 2 months ago. I feel like my story has been one mostly of exhaustion. But so I want to talk today about the affective or emotional dimension of my work with the adjunct union at Mills, which isn't usually where I begin when writing about the inequities, divisions, and hierarchies so necessary to higher education in its current corporatized structure. Usually I begin with numbers and data points. At Mills, this is familiar, but at Mills they go like this: we're over half the faculty, teach one-third the curriculum, and yet our wages represent only 15% of all faculty compensation. 2 weeks ago, when we were handed a devastating counterproposal at the bargaining table that would result in anywhere from 10 to 40% pay cuts for adjuncts, I was grateful I had those numbers pretty much memorized. But I want to back up and tell the story that got me there to an all-day bargaining session on Halloween when I came home afterwards, honestly high as fuck, and posted on Facebook that moment when you go so hard and look over and realize the college's lawyer is tearing up over injustice. And later she apologizes, it seems, for her job and how it has meant coming into the room and disrespecting you for a year. And it means nothing, structurally speaking, for her to say this, but also it happened. My personal story is complicated. We voted to unionize in spring 2014. The same day our vote was counted, the president announced a $4 million budget deficit, or was it $3 million or $5 million? Those numbers have fluctuated, mostly up, repeated endlessly as justification for a series of cuts. I was fired shortly thereafter from half my job without approval or knowledge of the department dean. I was at the end of a two-year contract, a hybrid faculty admin position I'd negotiated for myself after getting a job offer on the East Coast. My position as director of English graduate enrollment and programs surely influenced the way I participated during the campaign leading up to the vote. I helped out behind the scenes, but I didn't want my picture taken. I was the classic worker who feels both protected by their special relationship to management and terrified of losing it. The SEIU filed an unfair labor practice complaint claiming retaliation. We entered into bargaining that July. The college maintained that half of my job I'd lost was staff and therefore not covered by the union, which is pretty much what the NLRB ruled a few months later, although it became clear as tenured colleagues fought all summer to restore my position that the cut had everything to do with my adjunct status. I would hear these reports from meetings like the provost said the department can rehire, just not Stephanie, or it was inappropriate for an adjunct to do the work I'd been doing. Then I would go sit across the bargaining table from her. This person who'd called me down to the conference room where security guards waited to escort people off campus, which was odd because I still worked there, or the adjunct half did. I felt like a gnat, an easily squashed thing. Sweaty, heart racing, I stumbled over my words. Between then and now, we've worked with three different provosts at the table. Only one person remains on the president's cabinet who was there before she arrived from a long career in Big Pharma. Sometime during the last year, I became adjunct in a way I was protected from before. I prep for classes later than I used to because they might get canceled. I'm anxious about student evaluations. But the admin half, the deep institutional knowledge, has been activated on behalf of my peers. I work as much as I did before, but now half that work is unpaid. I was updating my CV earlier this fall and feeling bad when I noticed how little poetry I've published in the last year. And then I remembered it's been a hard year, and also how much of my writing during this time has been collective and often anonymous, things you can't put on a CV but which matter maybe more for other reasons. Drafting contract proposals falls into this category of labor and time-intensive collective projects, often contentious, the endless revisions of what I hope will be, sooner rather than later, a first contract that does not include $250,000 in pay cuts for the most vulnerable members of the faculty. So I've become the person willing to say that at the table, how unjust it is, how little we already make, how disrespectful, while the five top paid administrators in 2013 split $1.3 million between them. And actually, I didn't say that part, so best our negotiator did, which is smart because administrators get so touchy when you talk about their salary. But I did say thanks. Thanks for organizing the adjuncts better than we could have, for helping us take the first steps towards a strike. As I'm saying this, I'm looking in her eyes the whole time, data points like lasers of righteous, holy rage. I'm not crying, I'm not stumbling over my words, sweating like crazy from adrenaline, but in no way abject, and for a moment the provost's face falls. You can see it like a shield when the budget narrative comes down. She says quietly she's not the only decision maker, and I say, yes, I'm sorry, you're the only body who has to sit here and listen to this. And that's when I hear the lawyer say, I'm here, I hear you, I'm writing it all down. And when I look over, there's tears in her eyes, and she is a total shark, really nice, but still a total shark, that moment. The other is also complicated, and one I've just begun thinking about, so in the interest of time, I'm just going to finish with another Facebook status update. Which is thinking about a frustration I've heard expressed the last few weeks that white students and faculty didn't support the black student collective 2 years ago as strongly as they're fighting cuts now. Thinking about how the BSC list of demands remains largely unmet by administration, how that moment and this one are connected, and yet the failures, mine included, of 2 years ago make organizing together now almost impossible. How 2 years ago I mostly kept my head down, which had a lot to do with the structure of my job before I got weaponized. How differently I lived my precarity pre-union.
I'm going to read excerpts from two different workerist writers. One is from the Karen Brodine, who's a Bay Area socialist feminist organizer and poet. This is from her long poem, her series, Women Sitting at the Machine Thinking, a series of work poems. She thinks about everything at once without making a mistake. No one has figured out how to keep her from doing this thinking while her hands and nerves also perform every delicate, complex function of the work. This is not automatic or deadening. Try it sometime. Make your hands move quickly on the keys, fast as you can, while you are thinking about the layers, fossils, the idea that this machine she controls is simply layers of human work hours frozen in steel, tangled in tiny circuits, blinking out through lights like hot red eyes. The noise of the machine they all sometimes wig out to, giddy, singing through the shut-in space, blithering atoms. Everyone's hands pause midair above the keys when Neil or Barbara solo, wrists telling them every little thing, feet blipping along, shoulders wraggling. She'd always thought of money as solid, stopped. But seeing it as moving labor, human hours, why this means it comes back to her hands on the keys, shoulder aching, brain pushing words through fingers through keys, trooping out crisp black ants on the galleys. Work compressed into instruments, slim computers, thin as mirrors. How could numbers multiply or disappear, squeezed in sideways like that? But they could, they did, obedient and elegant. How amazing. The woman whips out a compact, computes the cost, her face shining back from the silver case, her fingers sharp tacks calling up the digits. When she sits at the machine, rays from the cathode stream directly into her chest. When she worked as a clerk, the rays from the Xerox angled upward, striking her under the chin. When she waited tables, the micro oven sat at stomach level. When she typeset for Safeway, dipping her hands in processor chemicals, her hands burned and peeled and her chest ached from the fumes. Well, we know who makes everything we use or can't use. As the world piles itself up on the bones of the years, so our labor gathers. While we sell ourselves in fractions. They don't want us all at once, but hour by hour, piece by piece, our hands mainly and our backs, and chunks of our brains, and veiled expressions on our faces, they buy. Though they can't know what actual thoughts stand beyond our eyes. And they toss out the body on the sidewalk at noon and at 5, and they spit the body out the door at 65. Each morning, fresh thermos of coffee at hand for the slowing down, shift gears, unscrew the lid of the orange thermos, pour out a whiff of home, morning paper, early light, a tangible pleasure against the unlively words. Funny, though, this set of codes slips through my hands, a loose grid of shadows, with big gaps my own thoughts streak through. Call format 05, reports, disk 2, quad left return, name of town, address zip, quad left return, roll along and there you are, down with this one, start the next. Call format 05, my day so silent yet taken with words, floating through the currents and cords of my wrists into the screen and drifting to land, beach polywogs. All this language handled, yet the room is so silent, everyone absorbed in feeding words through the machines. Enter, file, execute. Call file Oceana, name of town, Pacifica, name of street, Arbor. Thinking about lovemaking last night, how it's another land, another set of sounds, the surface of the water, submerged and floating free, the delicate fabric of motion and touch, knit with listening and humming and soaring. Never a clear separation of power, because it is both our power at once. Hers to speak deep in her body and voice to her own rhythms, mine to ride those rhythms out and my own and call them out even more, a speaking together from body to mouth to voice. Replace file Oceana, call file Island, scroll up, scroll down, what is there to justify? The words gliding on the screen, like the seal at the aquarium, funny whiskers, old man seal, zooming by upside down, smirking at the crowd, mocking us, and his friends the dolphins, each sharp black and cream marking streamline as the they want this over and over. May 1st, May 1st, May 1st, May 1st, enough? May Day, May Day, May Day, May Day. I think I'll just leave it at that.